Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Friday, March 22nd, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's listening here today, whether you're live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives. And secondarily, because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we'd appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number. I'll announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. And you can also, from that same website page, get a host of audio files that contain the records of people calling into the show and getting steps through the worksheet process so that if you listen to them, they can serve as a tutorial and help you get maximum benefits from the use of these tools with minimal amount of time expended. And if you're getting any comments, questions, testimonials you'd like to share with us, you can give us a call, but you can also email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. And or you can email Jeannie at J-E-A-N-I-E at whyagain.org. That's W-H-Y-A-G-A-I-N.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you from an email, we will address it on the internet show, and then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so that you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. And we greatly appreciate whenever anybody does that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be of service, and that's just a whole lot easier to do when we know how these things are landing for you. So please feel free to give us some feedback. And as I like to say, even if I seem to be in the middle of reading something or in the middle of a monologue, feel free to send an email or call 563-999-3581 and press the number 1 on your phone, and it'll let me know that you have a comment or a question to share. I received a link from Susan Bingham about a podcast that her daughter did with two people who are on either side of the struggles in the Gaza Strip, the Israelis, the Palestinians, etc. And I have posted it on Facebook. I listened to it, about an hour and a half discussion with these two men. And I also sent it to David Gruder because I know he is Jewish. He's a rabbi. He's a spiritual leader. His response was, thanks, there have been reconciliation groups between Arabs and Israelis and between Jews and Muslims in Israel for many years. They have been tacitly dismissed with an attitude of, isn't that nice, rather than, this is the future we must offer. So he suggested another interview that talks about why people reject the peaceful path and promote the let's just kill everybody on the other side path. So I will look at that, but I can recommend the podcast from Susan Bingham, where her daughter, who is, I believe she said she's a bishop in the Episcopal Church, and her podcast is titled Find It with Kate Moorhead. And this episode of Find It is an hour and 33 minutes long, and it was released March 16th. So I recommend it. It is moving. I had tears several times while listening to it. And it's an eye-opener. One of the people at the end was saying that, you know, it's part of the problem is that the government there doesn't even want them to go into the schools with their message of love and reconciliation for whatever reasons. And so it gets squashed. So if you would be so kind as to, if you have any interest in that, listen to that and or promote it, send it to people, and raise awareness that there are people constantly working for reconciliation and peace and forgiveness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Even while there are others constantly working for aggression and suffering. And we each get to make a choice. What are we going to focus on? One of the people in the interview said the very same thing that I say to many people in my support, in my caseload, and also on the internet show and support groups, that he said, I just don't listen to the news anymore. I get the input and the news I need from the people I hang out with, but the news is just going to tell you the latest bit of violence. They're not going to tell you about all the groups that are working for peace and reconciliation. And they're not going to give you the pathway to peace or forgiveness. So that's yet another thing that we've promoted on a regular basis. Either turn down the news or turn off the news. And by turn down, I mean just listen to a very limited bit of it, whether it's in the morning or the evening, and then live your life and be around other people and take steps to do something that you have control over to make your life better and the lives of those around you better. And it's literally, when you choose to do that, it's literally voting with your pocketbook, as they say. It's literally decreasing the ratings. And that's a good thing to do, decrease the ratings, because the higher the ratings they get, the more they just keep pumping out the same recommendation for violence and recognition of the violence and the trauma. And what we would like to do and hope you would support us in doing is raising awareness of the benefit of choosing for love over fear and choosing for compassion and choosing for reconciliation over conflict. And I know these are not, the easiest podcasts to listen to or the easiest topics to engage in, which is why every time I recommend it, I recommend tapping into those that are focused on the positive, focused on the solutions people are working towards rather than constantly focusing on the sensationalism or the extreme negativity. But again, that podcast is Find It with Kate Moorhead. And I understand that the investment in time is something might shock people, an hour and 33 minutes. And that's okay. If that's too much time for you, you might just listen to the first half or listen to the last half or not listen, but, pass it on to somebody you think might be interested. That's the thing about the serious problems we have in our lives. They're not going to get better all by themselves. And it is going to take a bit of an investment. Just like the Way of Mastery says, the way is easy and without effort, but it does take commitment and vigilance. And those might sound contradictory, but they're not. It's about being committed and being vigilant and this is one of the ways Dr. Michael Rice talks about it. He says it doesn't take a lot of hard work, but it does take some effort. You have to be willing to direct your mind energy in that area. You have to be willing to take some action to do something differently. This is why the Way of Mastery says in the lesson we were just reading, you have to be willing to use time differently. And once you decide to do that, it does seem effortless and easy because it's what you've been doing. It's living your life, basically, the way you've always been living your life, and just choosing to point your mind energy in a different direction. So 563-999-3581. Willing to entertain comments and questions about how both these statements can be true. The way is easy and without effort, and the way requires vigilance and commitment. And I understand how that, at first glance, can seem directly contradictory. And yet, there are ways to look at it, the ways to understand the work that you do in your life, the way you've directed your, the powerful energy that we call mind energy, your conscious logical thought, and understand that as you do that and direct it in one area or another, it's a creative process. You're going to be creating more and a direct experience for yourself of more of whatever you focus on. So area code 541, you're in the air.
Hello, this is Celinda. Good morning.
Hello.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Is it possible to put that on MindShifters, your MindShifters website?
The MindShiftersAcademy.org website?
Yeah, yeah. Can you put that on, or would you be willing to?
Yes, and why? I can, and why are you asking that?
Well, for two reasons. One, because it would be easy for me to access, and two, and also in the notes, if that link can be put in the notes of the radio show, that would be great too. And two, because maybe I can encourage people to take a look at MindShifters Academy or whyagain.org, a radio show and things like that. Especially when I come up against people who adamantly don't want to hear about it. You know, they just, so I don't.
They don't want to hear about what?
About any belief system, or not even belief system, but any perspective that is different than theirs. So when they say, I'm not interested, or I understand they're not interested, I don't say anything at all. But the first thing I could begin with is I listen to this podcast or something like this, and this is where it can be found if this is something that's interesting to you. I'm trying to find a way so I can stay out of preaching. I can just know when I can say something, and or it's positive, it's beneficial to say something, and when I just say, okay.
Okay. Well, and the question I have is how it would be of any benefit to put it on MindShiftersAcademy.org when anybody who has a device that they listen to any podcast on can go there and search for that podcast, and it'll come right up.
Can you access it straight without going? Can you access it straight by just putting the link in, or putting that words
find it
with Kate Moorhead?
Wherever you get your podcasts, if you put it in search for the podcast, find it.
Oh,
probably
okay.
Even
so
just find
my,
it. Hey, it'll come up on your iTunes, on your iPhone, it'll come up. On Spotify, it'll come up. Whatever.
Okay, good. Because I don't do podcasts, you know, except for like I call in for the radio show, and that's about it. But I get these podcasts by going straight, researching it on my DuckDuckGo, and I can find it there. Good. Okay, that's a question I wanted to ask you. Yeah. Long as I can find it easily, and maybe Jeannie can put the link in the notes, that's perfect.
Yeah,
thank you for sharing
the
way.
You can go to either Spotify or iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and type in Find It Kate and hit enter, and it comes right up.
Okay. Perfect.
And as for the idea that somebody says to you, I'm not interested, I don't think I would want to put any extra effort into that.
That's right. Yeah, it would be prior to that. Or if I can kind of pick up their body language, if they're a kind of person who's not going to tell you because they're going to quote-unquote offend you. Yeah, I'm practicing that diligently. So that's good. Perfect.
Okay, anything else we can support you with today?
Well, I had a thought, but you know what? It just flew off, so I'm good. Thank you. And, I know I was saying I really appreciate your mentioning this because it seems like the walking between these polar positions where people have basically, they're not going to watch anything but what they want to watch. And maybe all of us do that. Maybe that's just choosing something different. Once we choose something different, then that's where we put our attention. So it's not like it's wrong or anything. I would like to stay off of the firing range, though.
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well,
staying
I would
off
like
the
to...
firing range. What does it mean
I don't
to stay off the firing range?
It means I don't really want to be any more of a target than is necessary for somebody else's rage. And so I try to walk the middle and try to see the big picture. So if you have any clarification about that, that's fine. I feel comfortable doing with what I'm doing now. I also know I have edges that I can smooth of my beingness. And so sometimes it's hard to put into words, Dr. Kim.
I would imagine, because I'm getting lost between staying off the firing range and smoothing the edges of your beingness. I don't really know where you're going with that.
Okay. No problem. I just want to be love, expressing in the world. And so
then go ahead and do that. Well,
okay.
Go ahead and do that. And if somebody perceives you as being something other than that, you know, our primary recommendation in this work is be willing to entertain the possibility that there's something viable or valuable in what they're saying, and just look at it. At the same time, hold to what you know works for you.
Exactly.
So you don't instantly change just because somebody says, you know, you're wrong or you're not being loving. At the same time, you know, the smart money is on listening to feedback, being willing to give it a shot, evaluate it as, you know, critically as you can, and then go ahead and just make your own decisions about your life and how you're going to choose to live it and let other people have theirs.
Yep, that is my challenge, definitely. And I'm floating in that direction.
All righty then. Anything else we can do to support you today?
Nope. I'm trying to grow ears.
Okay.
Actually,
all right.
I'm doing it slowly. Thank you very much for everything you offer.
You're welcome and deserving. I'll mute you so you can listen to the rest of the show. And invite any other comments or questions, answers, or testimonials. 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1. We can have a conversation. I know that in a curious synchronicity between Susan Bingham sending me that notice of a podcast, the We Can Do Hard Things people also did an episode related to talking about both sides of the Palestinian and Israeli conflict. And the title of that one, it's episode number 292, and the title of it is What These Palestinian and Israeli Activists Need Us to Know. Standing Together is a group. So Standing Together's team of Sally Abed and Alan Lee Green are interviewed on the March 20th episode of We Can Do Hard Things, episode number 292. And after I listened to the podcast with that's been recommended by David Gruder, where he says, here's one of the unspoken reasons why people push for annihilating one side or the other rather than for peace. And they're going to talk about that in that podcast. And if it's viable and useful, I'll share that on Monday. In the meantime, we're just here working to choose love as soon and often as possible, as is recommended by the Way of Mastery. And I should mention that the second half today is going to be a recording. Jeannie has asked me to play a recording because they are playing today. They have their granddaughter with them, and so they're going to be having fun. And we can carry on. I suppose they will be back on Monday. Since nobody has any hand up, but somebody just did put a hand up, so area code 610, Susan.
Hi, welcome. Dr. Tim. I came on late, so you haven't had the chance to listen to the We Can Do Hard Things, right? I can't imagine that you squeezed that in your morning.
No, I listened to the one that you sent me, that your daughter was the host of the podcast.
Okay. You're going to love the... Go ahead.
That's why I sent you the note that actually uses a quote from the end of that podcast.
Right.
Which
You're
is the motto...
The other one.
Which is the motto that they have chosen for their group.
Oh, they have? Oh, that's wonderful. I didn't realize that.
The motto is holding on to humanity. And that's why I sent you the message that says, I join you in holding on to humanity.
Right.
This is the family's circles, whatever that,
oh, okay.
Whatever that,
yeah.
It's got a long name, but these two men that your daughter was interviewing have both been helped into reconciliation, love, and forgiveness away from vengeance by that group.
Right. Yeah. And how they're doing it, and they're doing it, one of them's doing it through running a camp for children. This is how to get them. Bruce Lipton, I think it was, gave a short talk a while back on how Palestinian children and Jewish children are being taught in the school to see the other side as enemies. And this has got to change, and evidently it's being changed radically in these groups, these camps, which include Palestinian and Israeli children. So they get to see each other as friends and cohorts and people.
That's the idea of holding on to humanity.
Yeah.
We're seeing each other as people, rather than as stormtroopers in Star Trek with no face. All the faces look the same, and you can objectify and dehumanize people. And that is part of why it was so powerful in that discussion at the end, where they said, we are not allowed to bring our message into the schools because the government is barring it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an active set of forces pulling for the conflict and the war, and we have to recognize that and simply refuse to cooperate with that and choose again for love. And do that in our own little ways as a grassroots movement that hopefully will spread like wildfire eventually.
Hope so. Will the one, the podcast with We Can Do Hard Things, they, both of them, I think, are running peace groups, and there are links, which I haven't looked at. People can join or contribute to them for their work. So it's very much on the ground, busy doing this humanitarian work. It's extremely heartening to listen to them talk. So those are good, two good podcasts to put side by side. The stories run parallel. I have a friend, a wonderful woman in her 40s who has adopted two or three children, kind of catching them out of the system in free fall and bringing them home with all sorts of problems. And she's living in a part of Pennsylvania that's extremely red. And she's very politically savvy and kind-hearted. And what she's doing is going around and just talking to her neighbors. And her neighbors turn out to be people, of course. And they don't immediately know that she's one way or the other, but they find one another's most painful issues. One woman was talking about how upset she was because she has a teenage son who wants to be a girl. And this woman is very much against anything like that. And my friend is not. And she said to her, well, or the woman said to her, I just hate this and I don't want this. And she said, well, I do think it's probably a good thing to have a good look at it. And the other woman says, why? And my friend said to her, so that they don't kill themselves. And that, of course, cut right through to the natural mother in this very conservative woman. And she said, what do you mean, kill yourself? And my friend said to her, they are really feeling so misunderstood and isolated, what with the pandemic and the political, together with these identification issues, that they are, the suicide rate is up. And the woman said, oh, my God, I've got to learn more about this. And the woman has completely turned around in many areas because of this kind of connection. That's the humanity again. So we have to do this in this country. We're talking about Israelis and Palestinians. We are doing this in this country. We are seeing the other guys as bad guys, stupid, stubborn, uneducable, et cetera. All of that has to be looked at. So the work these people are doing, mentioned in these podcasts, this is our assignment for right here with our next-door neighbors. I thought that was just gorgeous. Both of them, beautiful podcasts.
Well, and of course, the solution to this, these kinds of problems is education. And that is why so many people try to keep it out of education.
Right.
Because it would have a solution that goes in a direction they don't want.
Right. So we've got
to... So the more educated each of us can be, the better.
Mm-hmm. But we have to do it one-on-one, outside the systems often.
Or in small groups that...
Yeah. Right.
Right. Like they're recommending in this work. And of course, we have to be aware. It probably won't be as dramatic as Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, but we have to be aware that when we try to put some education out there or try to make a stand for choosing love over hate or war or conflict, there will be people that want to push back. And
yeah.
That's where the challenge then becomes even greater. When they're pushing back, can we still live into what we say we want, which is to choose love over hate, to choose love over fear, and to allow them to have their position and stay calm, stay loving, stay accepting, stay compassionate.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's the biggest challenge because so many of us are trained into the idea that if somebody disagrees with us, we have to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We either have to get defensive or we have to go on the attack.
So
there's that's part of that vigilance and commitment that we were mentioning from the Way of Mastery. It isn't as hard as it would seem, but it is going to take undoing the old conditioning. It is going to take vigilance and commitment.
Mm-hmm. And breathing. One thing that you often say is if you are in upset in any way, you are in error.
Whatever your mind is showing you is going to be a lie, absolutely.
Yeah. That's like heavy artillery. I wish there were another word that was a little more of a no man's land, you know, a connecting thought. Because being in error is like saying, you're wrong, and then Yeah.
Right? You probably have a good intention, but if you're in error, it's your own internal alarm system trying to let you know that whatever you've decided is not in alignment with the truth of life.
Mm.
And the thoughts that you're generating around that are not going to be productive. They're not going to lead to anything that you would prefer to have experienced in your life. And that's the alarm system. It's like, I wish there was something other than gravity so we could float and fly and not need planes. Okay, me too. I've wished that ever since I was a kid and wanted to be Superman. But it doesn't help me to pretend there's no gravity.
Mm.
And that's one of the harsh realities that we're going to have to come to terms with if we're going to ever make any progress. What's the harsh reality? That if I'm in pain, internally upset, frustrated, it means my mind is in error. My thoughts are off the mark. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean I should be attacked or that I should go attack somebody else. It just means I can turn the focus inside, pay attention to my own alarm system, wake up to what it's trying to tell me, and make better progress once I've done that. Because if I keep charging forward thinking I know what I know and I'm right, and there's any kind of upset in me, it's not going to go well.
Right.
It's like, you know, just shutting off the fire alarm in a building and not checking for where there might be, you know, a fire or smoke or whatever. I don't want to hear the alarm. Okay. But it's not going to go so well.
No. You do say, though, you remind us to the word error or the word wrong or the word mistake, those are war terms, kind of like in the extreme.
That's why we say off the mark.
Yeah, that's
right.
Much better. And then to say what you can do, which is to breathe, soften, allow, be curious, observe, create a space where nothing is decided, but you're just having a new look. Yeah.
Yeah. Choose again. Choose for love. Choose for peace. Yeah, it is entirely possible to benefit far more from my situation once I recognize what are the energies that I'm experiencing trying to communicate to me. What are these emotions? And if they're unpleasant, they're trying to let me know, Tim, your thoughts are off the mark.
Yeah. Michael gave me a mind shifter, and I've mentioned it before. I hope I can find it because I don't remember the exact words. Okay. I willingly allow my past to be removed. Well, that just takes care of everything, doesn't it? Because
yep.
It's our preconceived notion. My first word on the other side of the page is bullshit. So
yeah.
That was a challenging worksheet.
Well, but, you know, that mind shifter is going to get at everything eventually if you keep working at it. Because the issue is, whenever I'm upset, you know, the Way of Mastery and the Course in Miracles tell us in various ways that I'm never upset for the reason I think I am.
Right.
So whenever I'm upset, my mind is telling me it's because of what's going on right now here in the present. And the fact of the matter is, it's always about the past.
Right.
It's always about something. It is. It's something that I have decided. Made a decision about, have some thoughts about, and that's an old tape playing. It's based in a lie or a falsehood. And if I sit and spin thinking about it, speak or act from it, it's just going to get worse, not better. It's going to make my life worse, not better.
It's totally wild. If you take that, anybody could do that mind shifter and spend the rest, as you said, spend the rest of your life on it. If I remove my past, I become a doormat and we suck dry, used up, taken for granted, and not appreciated. I will have no more moorings, no guidelines. I'll have no spine and no character. I will be like an amoeba. That's pretty funny. Yeah. But it comes right back up. This is like, have you ever seen those things at gas stations? These inflatable, tall, skinny men with arms out, and the wind is blowing them up, and then they collapse. And the wind's blowing them up,
yes.
And they collapse.
Yes.
It's like that. The wind keeps blowing them right back up again.
So what is just like that? Your resistance to this is like
that? The fact that you can, yeah. I willingly allow my past to be removed. I'm perfectly happy to do that. And then I find millions of reasons. The hot air blows in, and I have my reasons for not giving up the past over and over and over again. There's going to be no end to this mind shifter. You know, you're supposed to sit there for 3 or 4 hours with your phone off. Well, after 3 or 4 hours, I mean, it's been a week and a half or something. Of course, I'm not sitting with it the whole time, but I keep reinstating it and getting more resistance. Anyway, this is just a complaint. I'm not asking you to solve it.
Well, but it isn't so much a complaint even as it is just a description of the strength of the habit of thought. And every one of us who wants to make progress is going to have to be willing to confront our own habit of thought and at least open it to questioning.
Right. Well, that's what those people did in those podcasts. Is two Israelis on two different podcasts and two Palestinians who had plenty of reason to hate the other side to the point where they would never even want to speak to them. And they got past that.
Thank you. Well, you know, there are books like The Lemon Tree and many others that talk about this and have for generations and certainly for decades. And there are individuals at the grassroots level that have awakened to the fact that we're all just people. And these artificial, arbitrary delineations of where you live on the planet and what color your skin is or what religion you are, none of it makes us any different from the other person in any way that truly matters. It's the idea of, you know, when people say, so what's your talk about this, I say, listen, the only significant difference between you and anybody that's ever lived or anybody that ever will live, think about what I'm saying. The only significant difference between you and anybody that's ever lived or ever will live is the degree to which you are able to live from the realization that we're all the same.
That's good.
And it sounds like just doublespeak. What? The only difference is that we're all the same? What do you mean? That means there's no difference. But the fact of the matter is, for the vast majority of people, if you needed a blood transfusion, it wouldn't matter what their religion is or what their skin color is or where they were born. It's got nothing. We're all just human beings. There is no such thing as different races. Right? The science says we're just human beings. You can make all of these artificial, arbitrary delineations and then live your life as though they're significant, but that doesn't change the fact that we're all the same. And none of us truly knows how we got here, where we came from, who or what created us, etc. So rest into that. Look for all of the signs your mind is going to try and feed you about how different we are. And when you find that and you register the tension arising in your body, just recognize, oh, this is my alarm system. My own, you know, creator-given, built-in alarm system. And the best use of it is to wake me up to the fact that whatever I'm thinking right now is not the truth. Or at least it's only partially true. Hope that makes sense.
It does.
I get
the
resistance.
Partially.
Yeah, the partially.
The partially
and
is
the
big one.
Yeah, well, because it gives some breathing room, right? It's like when the Course in Miracles, where the lesson is the new beginning, and Michael has a video on this, but in it says, look, we understand that it's very, very difficult for humans to admit they're wrong. So we're not even going to ask you to admit you're wrong. We're just going to suggest that when you have upset, when you've got anger, etc., that at least you scan your body and notice how you feel. And if you don't like how you feel, at least you start to say, well, I don't like how this feels. I hope there's another way to look at the situation. So you don't have to start out saying, oh, I must be wrong. You can ease into it by just recognizing that it's not a pleasant sensation to have all of this anger or this tightness or this tension. And once you recognize that, then perhaps you're willing to say, I hope there's another way to look at this. And from that other way of looking at it, perhaps I won't generate as much upset, as much discomfort.
Mm-hmm. And you might even find some solutions to a situation that you really shouldn't have to be living in, but doing it clean.
Well, and that's the thing, is that, you know, once we give up what we know, and we ask questions, we learn to live in the question, we dramatically expand our field of view and the options that become possible. So, you know, this comes around full circle to the idea of, can you learn to live in the question? Because it's a far more productive, flexible, learning-enabled position than the position of knowing.
Yeah.
And most of us have been not just told, hey, you better know. We've been conditioned with punishment and rewards to think we need to get it right and to know, and it's not okay to be in the questioning mode. You know, this came up one of the...
Yeah.
Go ahead. Would I just what?
Or just to let a situation stay in limbo. I'm thinking of Michael downstairs, of course. I always go there because it's still... a puzzling situation, to just allow things to go along without having a resolution, allow it to go along not knowing the absolute truth about why he's the way he is and why I feel the way I do, to just allow time to I do a lot of breathing just to loosen the edges. I have a built-in vise that tightens and tightens and tightens, and I push at it and letting go of the past, not knowing, reinstating not knowing anything over and over and over again. It's an ongoing, like breathing in and out, in and out, in and out. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that not too long ago on the On Your Mind podcast, not On Your Mind, on the We Can Do Hard Things podcast, Abby, who is, you know, a retired world-class women's soccer, professional soccer player, was talking about how one of the biggest shifts she's made and one of the most difficult things that she's done lately in her life is learn to say the phrase, I don't know.
Yeah. Right. Great.
Just
phrase.
Think about it. How could that,
yeah.
How could that be so difficult? Well, if you don't understand the conditioning of our culture, the punishment and reward system, and how intense it is about, you know, learning to be right and having the right versus wrong and good guys wear white hats and all this. I mean, just who's number one, who won the game, what was the final score, you know, who placed first in the race, all of this competition and reward and the punishment side of it, right? If you don't get enough answers right, then you flunk the test and you have to take it over, or you've got to take it used to be you'd have to, you know, take the whole grade over. And so there's a very powerful system that has conditioned us into those response patterns. Mm-hmm. And being afraid to admit that we don't know, or being ashamed or embarrassed to admit we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that does is keep us stuck in ignorance.
And allowing ourselves to not know, and allow ourselves to know that not knowing is perfectly safe.
Yes, and it's the only path to wisdom. Because if I won't acknowledge that I don't know, I can't open up and learn anything new. Not only will I not ask to be shown, when new information comes along, I'll reject it because I'm falsely holding on to a belief that I already know. So, you know, what some would say, ironically, you know, this thing about knowing and our obsession with knowing literally keeps us stuck in ignorance.
This is really helpful, Dr. Tim, even though it's not concrete. I mean, I imagine anybody listening might say, what are you talking about? But I appreciate you're just hanging in there and boring in, because it isn't, it's just so, I guess it's everybody's battle, but it feels so personal and abstract, because I'm thinking about a particular situation, but I hope others listening can apply it to their own situations, whatever's up for them.
Well, I am glad you're finding it useful. I think it's just the slightest bit abstract if your mind wants to make it abstract, but it's really simple and concrete. If I say I know and I fight for what I know, and there's any kind of tension in my body, any kind of anger or vehemence, I could wake up to the fact that my body and my energy system, my emotional warning system, is trying to let me know I'm off the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And I may not even be off the mark about what I think I know, but I'm off the mark about my internal processing and what that means. And that's how I'm generating this upset.
Yeah.
Because if I know and I'm right, I'm just calm. And I know and I'm right, and people tell me I'm wrong, I stay calm. I like to give the example of the aardvark. So let's just end on this. You know, if somebody came up to you and told you you were a horrible parent and you were a lousy wife and you're a lousy musician and whatever, you might have some part of you that kind of fears, uh-oh, maybe they're right. I need to get defensive and I need to attack back and I need to prove them wrong, et cetera. But if somebody came up to you and said, you know, what are you doing walking around in that human suit? I know you're really just an aardvark. You probably wouldn't have any upset because you've never, there's no part of you that secretly fears that you're a four-legged animal with long tail and a long nose that eats ants. Right?
That's good. Yeah.
So when you know what you know, you don't argue with somebody who tells you you're wrong.
That is
when
so good,
really
Dr.
Know,
Tim.
When there is no doubt within you at all, and there's no possible resonance that they might be right, there's no defensiveness or anything else. You just relax and say, okay.
That's really good.
All right, I'm glad you think so. I'm glad you think
so.
Let that sink in, and I will mute you so you can listen to the second hour. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. This is your second hour.
I was going to say, in Tuve Hun, and I'm going to come back to that word there for poor, we've got ripe, which is Tuv, the EY sound, genders this word feminine. It's the same as the ta at the end of a lot of words. And what that means is something that is a latent or you could say a potentiality becomes activated is the best way you can put that in modern English. And then the hun at the end means all of you who. And you know, there's one thing that's intriguing in the Beatitudes that if you don't read Aramaic, you can't you won't see it. You won't see it in Greek. You won't see it in English. Is all but one of, well, actually, what? 8 Beatitudes, he says, tuve hun, which means all of you here. One of the Beatitudes, he says, tuve kun, which means that he looked at one person and said it directly to that person, intriguingly. And then there's another one that actually doesn't have tuve hun in the beginning of it. But I'm doing this in English so you'll see it. If you look at the back, grab my business card back on the CD table and flip it, although you won't be able to pick it out, but I can point it to you. I actually show a copy from the ancient Aramaic Kaboris manuscript that shows two little dots that basically show up right here between what in English is the M and the S. Now, what's intriguing is the reason that this Aleph Beit, that this Estrangella style of writing was written, was because prior to that point they didn't use phonetic markings to record the teachings of Jesus, meaning no vowel sounds. And they had big problems with that, because without vowel sounds the word changes. Okay? Now if you have M-S-K-N together, let me hear you pronounce that M-S-K-N as a word. Every single person in here said Miskin. Okay? Now when you put those there, it changes it from Miskin to Maskin. Now let's talk about that just for a second. This is just the first beatitude. Now, there's two sets of meanings. Actually, there's a couple different meanings that all really mean the same thing. Miskin. Now, we've got poor. Miskin, if you have it with that flat I sound, Miskin means poor, as in lacking. When Yeshua would talk about give your stuff to the poor, he would say Miskin. M-S-K-N in English. And that's what you say naturally without a phonetic marking. But when you add that into Maskin, this is what that means, okay? Let's say you've got a wallet and you've got $6,000 in it and you've just got here to America and you have no job and your country is in civil war and your family was killed off. And here you are, everything you own is in this wallet. You don't even have a suitcase. And you're standing in New York City in the middle of the night in an alley, the same alley that you heard a crack a couple minutes ago, and all of a sudden a guy comes up behind you and someone grabs the $6,000 out, and you turn and he's way too far, you can't catch him. He's already turned the corner, you don't even know where he is. Every single possession that I had is now gone. I'm what? I'm poor. But I want to give you what that means in Aramaic, rather than poor as in lacking. I've got a wallet and I've got $6,000 in it, and I open it up and I take that $6,000 out and I put it in my pocket. The wallet is now what? Empty. Everybody breathing? Empty in spirit, which means not poor as in lacking, but empty as in open. That word empty, maskin, also means home or sanctuary. The word spirit in Aramaic is rucha. Spirit is a concept that the first century Aramaic mind would have had no clue what it meant. It's a Latin term. Spiritus is a Latin word that's gendered masculine, meaning that it's a physical thing. And we spend our lives trying to find spirit, yet again, in the words of St. Francis, what you are looking for is what is looking. Spirit and or breath in Aramaic, rucha, is feminine. Not poor in spirit, but empty and open, and home in breath, spirit, energy, magnetism, cosmic expansion, the eternal forces of the One. Now going even deeper in this, being feminine, it means this as well. In what do I feel on my arm right now? That's what? Breath, right? In John 3, Nicodemus and Yeshua are having a conversation, and Yeshua says, you must be reborn of water and spirit, is what we're told in the King James. Now, intriguingly, in Aramaic, what he says is maya and rucha. Maya, water, literally does not mean simply water. It means the great flowing expanse. It's at the end of Shemaya, which is the word heaven, which is also the word sky. And rucha, he wouldn't have said breath and spirit. He probably would have gone breath or water and spirit. He would have said water, maya, and because in the first century, spirit and breath were not two separate things. Spirit didn't exist in their mind because what we now think of as spirit as separate from breath at that time was simply rucha, which is breath. Now let me say one more thing. In the first century Aramaic mind, what you feel on your arm, that's spiritus, that's a masculine physical thing that we now call breath. Is everybody breathing? In Aramaic, it wasn't what I felt on my arm that was breath, that's hot air. In the first century Aramaic mind, breath was not the hot air that moved through my lungs, it was my feminine perception of its movement. It wasn't a thing, it was the experience of this. That's what Rucha is. And when you're empty in the expansion and the contraction of breath, spirit, energy, insight, growth, whatever it may be, that's what it meant. It didn't mean hot air on your arm. Is everybody clear? That's why we're out there looking for spirit. And as an example, I asked the question, will science ever find God? People are like, oh yeah, the superstring theories and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's interesting. Because quantum theory says that as you observe, you create, which means that whatever they're finding is them. And what they're not realizing is they're looking for what's looking. What they are looking for is what is looking. God is not thing, God. And that's a concept in Aramaic that it doesn't exist in Christianity. Allah, the word for God in Aramaic, means absolute only being. Interesting. You've got the ah sound, which is alaf, which means everything, lamed, which means movement, and ha, which means breath. The one lives and breathes within itself. Allah. And that's you. Is everybody breathing? If you ever feel like you're not getting something, let go of trying to understand it and just keep your breath moving. And what needs to happen will happen.
If you look at that Pentecostal experience where all kinds of awesome things happen and the tongues of fire upon their heads, the Greeks tell us that Yeshua breathed on them. It's not what it says. It says he breathed them. He showed them how to stay connected to that one holy breath. And you'll watch people in trauma, and the first thing that they do is cut themselves off from that whole breath. And when they cut themselves off, they literally cut themselves off from the eternal forces. Now they're locked within their own parameters. That is, what is their life experience and what's in their genes? You look at that story about the sins of the fathers are passed into 3 and 4 generations. What are they talking about? They're talking about the energy patterns. And when we're locked in, the sins of the father are passed into 3 and 4 generations. Anybody remember the second half of that passage? It says, yea, of those who hate me. It's not hate in terms of a love-hate relationship. It's those who are separated from the active presence of love in which we live, move, and have our being. And the way you separate yourself from it is by holding your breath. How many people remember them telling stories about you when you were 2 and you'd hold your breath until you turned blue and passed out? I've run into hundreds of people that's been their experience. And they spend most of their lives cut off from that flow that's designed to come through them. And they live in this intellect, in this 9-bit mind. Don't disturb my state of belief, because I already know. If you're in pain, you don't know.
You would have a much more accurate understanding of first century Aramaic teachings if you were to take the Jesus teachings and just pencil out the word spirit and write the word breath above it.
Yeah.
If you do that, just try it with one of those green Bibles, the Gideon Bibles you get, either on the urinals or in the drawer of the hotel room, and cross out spirit and write breath above it. Now, this is that phrase from, is it John 20:22? Jesus breathed on them. This is great theology because Jesus has all the power, just like Horus and all the ancient Egyptian guys and Dionysus and Osiris and Mithra. Napak lahun. If it said this, I'm doing this in English so you'll see it a little more clearly. This lamed, which is this, I told you it means movement. It means on, toward, or at. Now this is something that in modern Aramaic scholarship, a lot of them don't even know that these two, somewhere around 1700 years ago, became interchangeable, the lamed and the bet, in terms of a prefix. This means on, toward, or at, the la sound. So if it was napak lahun, it would be he breathed on them, or at them, or toward them. But what it actually says in Aramaic is napak bahun. Now, ba means with, within, or through. Not he breathed at them, on them, or toward them, but he breathed with them. He breathed them through. That's a whole different thing. Not him having power that he breathes on them, but what happens. This is after the resurrection and he's standing in front of them, if that actually happened. I'm pretty sure that if a guy that I knew all of a sudden and I saw hanging on a cross and I saw his dead body and all of a sudden he's standing in front of me, I'd probably stop breathing. I don't know if I would today. But, you know, I would say the average person would probably catch at least a little bit if there's like I said about Minnie Pearl earlier. If Minnie Pearl walked in the back door, I probably would do a little bit of a, you know. So, are you getting what I'm saying here? This is about...
What's your relationship with Minnie Pearl here?
I love Minnie Pearl. We are in the South, aren't we? You see the difference here? Now, here's the problems here is, the one problem we've got is that in modern Semitic scholarship, it's not even acknowledged that these two had separate meanings, with, within, or through versus on, toward, or at. So if a modern, many Aramaic or Semitic-based scholars translate, they don't know the actual first century difference between the two, and they become interchangeable, and all of a sudden the message changes entirely just because of a single letter.
Has anybody here ever been with someone the last 48 hours of their life when they were experiencing a non-crisis death? Anybody ever been with somebody? What did they do in the last 24 to 48 hours? They started to breathe like this. They connected in a whole breath, and then they'd hit a place called a still point, where they'd stop breathing altogether for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, until their lips start to turn blue. And then they'd go back, and they'd do that breath. I think that the person who's getting ready to leave their bodies intuitively knows they need to reconnect in order to process out the garbage that they're carrying with them and not have to take it with them. We're looking at clarifying the original Aramaic terms in the teachings of the man named Yeshua in particular, although not exclusively, in order to understand a thought system and a healing system that is disappearing from the planet. And we're looking to restore that first century thought system that has just had such longevity, even in distorted forms, that when we get back to the original, it just opens a whole different game. So we're delighted that you're here. And Dale Allen Hoffman is a local Aramaic scholar, probably the most practical scholar on the planet that I know of anyway. And he's going to open with the Lord's Prayer. And
to set the tone. Yeah. We did this. Anybody here last night? I'm going to come down here. What we're going to do is we're going to tone a sound together, which is the first word of the Lord's Prayer in a Far Eastern dialect. If you're in the West, it sounds more like Abvun or Abvunach, depending on where you are. If you go further into the East, it starts sounding more like Avun or Aun. We're going to do the Aun sound. Say that once, Aun.
Aun.
It's kind of like Om, but there's an N at the end. Say that one more time.
Aun.
Now I'm going to tone this sound one time, so you know what I mean by toning, without talking about toning a lot. Toning is essentially, just as a quick description, you're basically taking a sound that's normally sacred, really it could be any sound, it doesn't even have to be a word, and you're elongating the vowel sounds and allowing it to come through as deeply as you can in the present moment. It's not singing or performance, it's different. This isn't about having a great quality voice. It's just about having an open quality heart and presence in the moment, and the sound will take care of itself. So I'll tone one time, and then we're going to do this together three times, and then I'm going to go into the prayer, okay? And I'm just going to go into the prayer in Aramaic tonight rather than also English, okay? And you'll understand after this. You'll feel it. You'll feel why I did this to begin, okay? So just listen to this first tone. Remember the N, which is the letter Nun, at the end of the word, because all you're going to be doing from that ooh is just taking the tip of your tongue and resting it on the back of your upper teeth. Remember that sound. Don't forget that one, okay? So let's do Aum three times. This last one ring out, okay? Wide open, far beyond the expanse of this beautiful building. Last one. Now just be aware of your breath and be open. Avund Voshmaya Nit Kadash Shmah Tete Malku Tah Nehwe Tivyanak Aikana Voshmaya Ap Bearea Hablan Lachmadasun Kanan Yomana Washwoklan Hobain Wachtahain Aikana Dabhanan Shwakan Lachayavain Huela Tahlan Lenesiune Elapitsan Minbisha Metul Didelaki Malkuthach Wahil Wateshbukta La Alam Amen. Amen. From this rooted earth may all my actions flow. And so it is.
Sweet. Thank you. One of the most basic teaching of so much of the Western world is that there's something for you to fear. And it's the ever-present Almighty that if you do some sort of an offense, then you're going to be punished for eternity. And so we hear an interpretation in the Greek translations, and if you look at the Greek gods were all about control and fear, and, you know, I mean, the atrocities they committed are amazing, and that's been transferred into the Aramaic meanings, and we're told to fear love. The Creator is love. And if you look at how bizarre a concept that is, you look back into the Old Testament, it says, fear is a commandment of men. Men made that whole game up. And you've got to start to question. You've got to come out of insane belief systems in order to truly function as a full human being. And the word that is in place of that fear is really to have awe. And there's some interesting research that's come out of Stanford recently where they're researching the impact of awe on people. And what they're finding is that when people go into awe, when they can't process with their minds the way they normally do, and they are awestruck, that it transforms everything in them. It literally transforms their psychological state. It transforms the state of their health. It transforms everything. And so what is this state of awe? What do you want to, how do you move into that state of awe? And what's it really all about? Is it about doing the right thing for the wrong reason because we've been told if we don't do it, we're going to be punished? No, that's a thing called propitiation. T.S. Eliot gives us a really easy way to understand that word, which is not very popular in our culture. And he's got a poem where he says, "'Tis the highest treason to do the right thing for the wrong reason. And you look at people who've been trained through fear, and they continuously work to do the right thing, not realizing that every time they work to do the right thing, they in fact are resonating a disease within their own cellular structures by doing the right thing. Trained through fear, fear being in the cell, fear being a disease to the cell, one acts through fear and ends up destroying themselves, wondering where all these horrible diseases come from when the root of the disease process is in the training of fear. And so Dale's going to talk about the I am and what that really means and how awesome it is when you understand it from the Aramaic.
One thing that I think a lot of people have heard is Moses in that burning bush and the I am that I am, which could be translated from Hebrew as I shall be that I shall be, I am becoming that I am becoming, I am flowering that I am flowering, I am fractally expanding that I am fractally expanding. Yeshua used a different word when he was talking about I am. One of the questions I get asked the most in the last 20 years is, all right, hold on a second, I get everything else you're saying, but there's one hook I still have. Usually it's John 3:16 is one. We might get to that one a little later, but the thing I get asked the most is, what about when he says, I am the bread of life, or I am the way and the truth and the life, or I am the gate, I am the good shepherd, all these different places. All of those actually in the Gospel of Yohanan, John, incidentally. I put these up here on the board before we began, just thinking as an experiment, maybe it would burn its way through the board or something. It didn't. This is something that's so easy and clear to understand, and it's literally not possible to understand except from the Aramaic perspective. It's not that it couldn't be said in another language, but something I talked of yesterday is there's a big danger in translation without experience. And when I say experience, I don't mean past experience. I don't mean having 30 years behind you with translation. I mean open experience now in the moment. Without Gilyana, the revelation, the unveiling, there's no chance of you really bringing something through, because it's only going to come through in the perspective of what your mind can hold or handle or comprehend. And any translation is going to be a dumbing down. It's just the way it goes. This is something that's so easy to understand. Right here, it's got three letters, Aleph, Nun, Aleph. Sounds like this, Anna, Anna. So if anybody knows the name Anna, someone with the name Anna, this is what Anna means, I. Okay? I. It could also mean I am, but it's a very specific, it only has one meaning, which is either I as in I Dale or I Dale am. If I'm going to walk across the room, I would say Anna. Technically, let me put it this way, in Aramaic, it tends to most often be pronounced, even though you can see that it's the same ah. You can see that it looks like Anna. It tends to be pronounced as Ana or Ina, okay, or even Inna. I'm going to show you why. Well, I don't know exactly how the connection happened, but I'm going to show you why that is in a few minutes, okay? It's something that's going to be more important after you see what I'm going to unpack here. Now, Ana, Ina, Anna, this sound, if I, Dale, was going to do something, like I say, I would say Anna, going to walk across the room. You got that? Very clear. If Yeshua was saying, as an example, Ana Nuhra de Alma, I, Jesus, am the light of the world, Nuhra de Alma, the light of the world, or the light of creation, there's so many ways you can translate Alma, he would say, Ina Nuhra de Alma, I, Jesus, am the light of the world. But what's really intriguing is that in Aramaic, what's written on the page is actually this two times, not once. Now, you're about to learn a lesson in translation. If one Ina means I, what would two Inas mean? Us, we. Anything else? Who said it? I. Anything other than I would change its meaning. It's adding something that's not on the page. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you were to put two I's next to each other and say we, in truth, what you're doing is changing what is written on the page. What would be literal is I. Okay? Now, there's a quote that I gave a couple of times last night from St. Francis. Take a breath. St. Francis of Assisi said, "What you are looking for is what is looking." Not everybody's going to pick that up. If you're trying to understand it, you have 0% chance of understanding it. If you take a breath and let go, it's your only chance of getting that one. If you felt like even you don't quite get what I just said, then you got it, okay? So, I inside of the eye within the eye, not the physical eye, something behind the physical eyeball, but as an example, when you look in the mirror, that which is observing that reflection in the mirror is understanding that that's simply a reflection. The reflection is not what's real, nor is what it's reflecting. The only thing that is real is the observation or the awareness itself. Okay? I need you to breathe. Now, intriguingly, when you look at it like this, the eye within the eye, a good example of what eye within the eye is, we talked a lot about babies and holding a baby in the first 20 minutes of life. That's inanna, I. Now that I say inanna, even though it looks like ana on the page, the way we pronounce this is, in Aramaic, inanna. One of them is masculine. Masculine meaning it's me, physical person. When you've got two together, it's a feminine phrase, which means not a person or a thing, but rather a state of being and experience. Incidentally, Inanna is the ancient Sumerian goddess of love, fertility, and warfare. Inanna is what most of the Christian teachings are actually based on, the ancient Sumerian goddess. Most of the earliest Christian teachings are about goddess energy. They're about feminine energy. They're not about masculine things. Misogynists change those over time. Misogynist means literally woman haters, okay? Now, if you've ever listened to Bob Marley, you know, "Oh pirates, yes they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship." Minutes after they took I, one of the ways you can understand that is, I am, in Aramaic I'm going in this direction, okay? It's the I within the I. Pirates, yes, they rob I. I am projected into this world, though I am not of it. You getting what I'm saying? It's about the awareness behind who you think you are. It's about consciousness itself. That's the bread of life. That's the resurrection and the life. That's the light of the world. And what sees through me is what sees through you. If you were to actually imply that a man was any of those things that Christianity has done today, you committed a blasphemy, you turned his teachings 180 degrees exactly opposite, and you killed the message. Imagine this. Imagine that we've got one singular body of God, and let's just, you know, when we think cosmos or universe or multiverse, I'm talking everything, whether it's manifest or non-manifest. Does it make a lot of sense, even looking at it this way would be even better, does it make a lot of sense with one singular light that manifests itself in billions of human bodies, would it make any sense whatsoever to point at one of those lights and say that one of those lights is better than the others? One of those is only begotten. One of those is the bread of life. Is there any sense in that whatsoever? It's not the light on the board that's the light of the world. It's light itself. Do you feel that? Do you sense it? If you're trying to understand this, you have 0% chance. If you, as I said in the beginning, if you take a breath, keep your breath moving and allow your heart to be open and you feel that movement of the spirit, then you've got it. Everybody's had those moments in meditation, music, holding a baby in your arms where everything just works out just right and you're in that divine balance and it's almost as if you're the witness or you're observing your human life. That's what he was talking about. Interesting. It changes all of those completely, totally and completely. That's the light of the world. And we could spend 5 hours going through all of those phrases. So,
well, it's interesting that the only thing that changed was the pronoun when he said to those before him, "You are the light of the world." If you choose to step into that being within, you know, and it ties in with the idea of which to the average person doesn't make any sense, in order for you to live, you've got to die. Well, when we get lost, as we talked about yesterday, in this carbon-based memory system, we literally build information into the mind based on messages that come from the world of hostility or fear, and those messages that come from the world of hostility or fear tend to drag us out of the state of being. Hold the newborn child, you've got the active presence of love, you have this state of being that we all started as, and when we started there, the world did its best to drag us into those messages, and these messages based on a world of hostility and fear solidified or coagulated into a picture in the mind that most people call I. They fell from grace and they became identified with this. The moment of the deepest pain and the deepest rage that anyone will ever experience, and a moment that has to be worked back through. So when Yeshua is saying in order for you being to live, you non-being have to die. This self has to go. And this is the I behind what we call I. And that tends to get lost.
Is there anybody that doesn't get it right now? I haven't asked many questions the last couple nights. It's okay if you raise your hand. Here's the thing. If you were trying to grok it and understand it and you have no clue what I just said, it's because it's the reflection that's trying to understand. It's your human eye that's trying to understand. And the whole point of the entire passage, of those passages, is that it doesn't happen here. It's where it's projecting from. You know, Michael's got a great analogy that he uses a lot of times where, let's just as an example, say you're in some sort of a projection booth, movie theater, and you take some guy out of the jungle, and you've got an apple sitting on a table and it's projecting on a screen, and you take this guy from the jungle into this room, he's never seen a projector before, he's never seen a movie, and he sees that apple there, and you tell him, move the apple from this side to that side. Where's he going to go to move the apple? He's going to go into the world. He's going to go to the screen, the projection. And yet, Yeshua walks back in the projection booth, or the projectionist walks back into the projection booth, moves the apple, comes back out from that space within, and all of a sudden the apple's moved, and everybody goes, oh my God, holy Messiah, you've created miracles, when all he did was work within the system. It's one thing about, imagine this, let me put it, this is from Yogananda, he says, well, let me preface it with James Allen. James Allen says, what then is the meaning of fighting against circumstances? It is when one is continually revolting against an effect without, while all the while he is nourishing its cause in his heart. And another one from Yogananda says, when man transfers his sense of identity from his pseudo-soul or ego or mask or persona back to the true light of his being, he will realize that all pain is unreal. Suffering ceases to exist for one who is pure. And when we learn to view the scenes of the divine play of what we call the world, what Yeshua called the cosmos, he said, I come to destroy the world. You know what the word world is in Greek? Cosmos. I come to destroy the cosmos. Did he speak Greek? No. You know what that word is in Aramaic? Alma. Remember, I am the light of the world. I'm the light of the cosmos. Interesting. And I came to destroy that. And Yogananda said, to be able to view this Leela or divine play, the Maya, that world of liquid illusion, as the ever joyous witness of a stupendous cosmic drama. And that's that. It's taking your identity away from the echoes of your hidden past and coming back to the light of your being. How do you do that? You practice forgiveness, removing the root of your suffering.
And one of the number one pseudo-solutions of what we'll call the non-being mind, this is a state of non-being. It's a total fabrication. And as Dale said, if you're trying to understand from that, that non-being self can't understand everything, though it pretends life. It pretends existence. And all it is a projection from a set of brain cells based in hostility, fear, and pain. That's why most relationships based in that end up in divorce. because one who's not willing to be responsible for their hostility, their fear, or their pain ceases to be the light in their own lives and certainly ceases to be a light in that relationship. When two people really connect in true relationship, each of them begins to bypass this self that isn't, the self that can't understand anything, and be the light for each other, and in so doing forms literally a new energy, a new creation as such that was called the Pagra. The joining of two in that light forms a third entity. And so that third entity doesn't come from this state of non-being. And one of the number one pseudo-solutions, in one of our workshops, we go through what I call the pseudo-solutions of the non-being mind. And the number one pseudo-solution is, if I could just figure this out. Now, if we took everybody in the room and wrote down your age and added it all up and subtracted 5 years for every person in the room, we'd have the number of years that people in this room have been trying to figure it out. And if you notice, you can't figure it out. But here's what you can do and why Dale says forgive is the key. Because each time that you forgive, you literally remove, substitute. When you think actual forgiveness, substitute the word remove for forgive. And forgiveness means I remove this rage. I remove this fear. I remove this sadness. I remove this pain. I forgive this rage, this guilt. And think about what it's like to come into the world. You know, we asked the question last night, how many have held a newborn child? Describe the newborn. And everybody's descriptor is some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because everybody knows what human life is. When human life fuels your cellular structure, your physiology is in ecstasy, is in that state continuously. Think about what it would be like for a child, 2, 3, 4, 6, 10 months, 12 months, 15 months of age, to all of a sudden have received so many messages from the world that they are something other than the presence of love. Anybody ever get a message from your power person that you were something other than love? We had a woman, we asked this question. We're not going to do a dialogue or interaction on it, but we asked a woman a couple of years, or a group a couple of years ago, and this woman came forward, and she shared that when she was 6 years of age, her father came to her and told her that until she was born into the family, they had the perfect family. And when she was born into the family, she destroyed the family. Now think about what that kind of a message, when the child doesn't know how to refuse it, buys that message and forms a self out of it, that the mind actually takes all of those messages. And one of the things the human mind does is it converts information into pictures. It goes from digital to analog. So once we accept a certain amount of incorrect information about ourselves, then the mind starts to generate this picture of who we think we are. Imagine the pain that would be experienced by someone who started out at conception, has been fueled by love up until the age of 12, 14, 16 months, whatever, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and all of a sudden that is ecstasy is ripped away from them. And this true self goes blotto, and this self takes over. You have some reason why we have, or you get some insight when you realize that's what virtually all of us have gone through. You get some insight as to why the world is so insane, why there is such hatred and rage and murder. Because the pain of that moment is beyond comprehension. And it is a pain that each of us has to work our way back through. And the way that you work back through it, the key tool, and without this tool, whatever you're engaging in, whatever you're studying, you know, there are lots of interesting things in the world. But if it isn't showing you how to remove the lies that were planted into your mind, the lies that were resonated out of your genetics by those lies, if it isn't showing you how to forgive those things, to remove them, and ultimately collapse this non-being self so that the non-being self dies and the true self comes into existence, then that teaching, whatever it is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Who cares? The ship's going down. You know, you may be a little closer to the band, and so you hear the music better. You may get to the far end of the ship, so you're the last one whose toes hit the icy cold water, but the ship's on its way down. Whatever you engage in understanding how to remove the root of all hostility and fear so that the self that is not dies. And the true being that you are once again incarnates or comes back to habit this form and become the light of the world, become the light in relationship. If we're in relationship and Dale gives me the look and up comes my terror and I don't know how to hold love present for that, I don't know how to heal that, then I can turn to this person I have a power with and say, I need support, and Dale can become the light that supports my healing, and vice versa. So when we become that for each other in relationship, rather than, you know, if I'm in pain and I resonate Dale's pain, so Dale gets lost in his and I get lost in mine, and now we've got a schmozzle, we've got a mess.
The official word, schmozzle.
Schmozzle, yeah, it's an official. Yeah, it's a mayor make word.
Maybe, as it could be. It sounds like it, actually.
So when we can be that light for each other, the eye within the eye, then something different happens. And it transforms everything. And it moves into that state of a state that's so far beyond comprehension of this carbon-based memory system that we talked about yesterday, a state that's just so far beyond it that it's not even conceivable. And what happens when that I comes present, whether it's presenced by someone else or whether you're able to bring your own I present, then that state of awe is created and that energy begins to transform everything within you that is not like itself. That's what I understand Stanford is talking about when they're talking about how transformative that state of awe is. When your brain can't process it the way it normally does, it opens. And what opens in the presence of awe heals. And it heals instantly. And that's what, if you go back to Yeshua, again, 2,000 years ago, I come to bring you life, and more abundantly. There is no life in the body of its own unless it is plugged into the power supply it's designed for. My take is that the average person, as a human being, as love, is dead by the age of 4. Think about when the stress is up and the chips are down, the child, how many know of a child at 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 or 20 or 50 or 70 or 90 that stays present as love to the experience that is stressful for them? If you can't do that, then those stressful experiences bring up that non-being self that obliterates human life. Yeshua says, I come to bring you life. He didn't come to bring you fear about what God's going to do to you. I come to bring you life and bring it more abundantly and to show you how to incarnate that life by removing everything that doesn't belong. You must forgive from your heart, that is your own unconscious, that which you put into your brain's image of yourself and that which you put into your brain's image of your brother. And you think you feel what your brother did to you, but what you really feel is what's going on inside of you resonated by your brother. And when your brother comes and gives you the gift of rage, of hostility, of fear, and that resonates, rage or hostility or fear in you, they've given you the gift to recognize that if that's the energy that's moving in you, then you'll paint pictures on the inside of your eyeballs based in rage and fear. And when you do, you give up your human life. and you spray the energy of that hostility and fear on everybody that you look at. When you begin to remove those things, then that darkness is replaced by the truth of your being, of light. And when that happens, everything that you paint on the inside of your eyeballs, every construct that your mind makes is based in love and therefore sprays light on the world and transforms everything that happens. If we can get enough people through the gate of understanding and doing that work, and that's the challenge, doing the work, right?
What?
Yes.
Hmm.
Me? I have to change something?
You know, there's a couple of things you said that were so rich that, intriguingly, the word awe is interesting because we've got that word awful today. You know what's funny? We know what awful means today. If you go back and you look at literature from the turn of the 19th into the 20th century, awful wasn't a bad thing. And then full of awe. We've got terrific. That's terrific. You know, when Perry Como said the traffic is terrific in Home for the Holidays, I don't think he meant that he loved all the traffic, you know, around the Christmas holiday. We messed the words up. Yeah, and, you know, I mentioned briefly about Bob Marley earlier and the I. You know, it's intriguing to me that Rastafarianism has preserved many of the ancient Aramaic teachings of Yeshua better than Christianity has. One of the reasons for that is because Amharic, Ge'ez, and the Ethiopic languages come directly from Aramaic. Directly. Interesting. And, you know, the other profound thing that got me thinking was and I'm sure he'll probably come back to it, he went and talked about something about digital versus analog. Now, my business for 18 years before I was doing this full time was compact disc and CD and Blu-ray replication packaging, from polycarbonate to finished product. Interesting. And, you know, if you look at the surface of a CD, there's these things called pits and lands. It almost looks like the top of a castle. And these little pits here and these lands actually are basically little recorders or samples of information. Now, analog means this. Analog, cassette tape, vinyl, albums. This is a pure sine wave, something that's completely unbroken, something that's eternally it's always connected. There's no break in it. The funny thing about digital, much like a CD, is that it samples of information. And it's only going to pick up little samples of this. As an example, let's look at this. This is 128K MP3. This here would be a 256K MP3. It's got more information. This here is a 320K MP3. Every time you go higher with more samples, you're picking up more information. You want to go backward from an MP3, you get down around 96 samples per second, it starts sounding a little bit like this. You get far enough down, you've got Morse code. How much information can you jam into Morse code? Can you shove Stairway to Heaven into Morse code? Or like anything from Glenn Miller? Is that going to happen? It can't hold the information. Your brain can't hold everything. It can only give you a little teeny tiny bit of it. And we're living... This is that divine play. This is the 666. This is the Antichrist, that which keeps you from being an open channel in the world. And somehow we go through trying to understand and grok, and we believe what this thing is telling us, but this thing is only giving us little teeny tiny samples of the actual experience. This right here, that's who you are. You are that light. You're not you're not what's projected on the board. You are where it's coming from. And that's not something your brain can even handle or grok. It's what allows your brain to function, but this doesn't work in reverse. We've spent so much time looking at the movie screen thinking that that's who we were, and what Michael's doing here is he's showing us how to change the film strip and the projector. And the other aspect of that is occasionally just pull the film strip out. Just allow yourself to be open. Just be light itself. You getting what I'm saying? How do you do that? By breathing and forgiving and allowing yourself to be open. Stop believing your brain.
So it occurs to me there then, so this is not whole and this is holy.
Ah.
It's whole. It's connected. And when we live in this picture in our minds, I talked yesterday for those that weren't here about the Harvard research, it says in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, the max amount of information you can perceive is 9 bits. sampling, little pieces. And we believe what our brain shows us is true about something outside of us, when it is never true about something outside of us, because what our brain constructs its pictures from is samplings of data within, 9 bits out of 10,000. And when you can collapse that, and basically what first century Aramaic forgiveness does is it collapses those pictures that come from this carbon-based memory system that are painted on the inside of our eyeballs and radiate out energy waves that are like what we're painting with. If you paint a picture of somebody on the inside of your eyeballs out of your own hostility or fear, then you are spraying hostility or fear on them. The acid of hostility or fear is not anything that anybody enjoys having sprayed on them. When you change that and you replace it with the first law of Rachma, maintaining a condition of love in your mind, the gateway for love, then the pictures you paint on the inside of your eyeballs are sourced from another place. And that other place means that everything you look at is being sprayed literally with the high energy wave of the active presence of love. That transforms everything in your physiology and in your world.
Mm. You know, Michael mentioned that word holy. That's the Greek word holos, which means whole. The word in Aramaic and Hebrew is kadosh, kudsha, kadosh. What that means is not holy as in better than secular. It means all-encompassing, all-embracing, whole. You know, one of those phrases that we were given was, as an example, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's an interesting thing. Be perfect. Anybody ever tried to build or construct the perfect life? All the seminars you went to, workshops. We live in Asheville. We're on overload on that whole thing here, okay? And there's no shortage. There's probably 500 other healing whatever things going on tonight, Tuesday night here in Asheville, North Carolina. But here's an interesting thing about that word, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. That word is gemira. And what gemira means is whole, all-encompassing, all-embracing. Another place is in 1 Timothy in the writings of, this is Paul, where he says, perfect love casts out all fear. Perfect love casts out all fear. Now, intriguingly, that word in Aramaic for perfect, let's remember, this is Saul of Tarsus. This is a native Aramaic speaker. The letters that he did not write in Aramaic, except for some Greek letters that he wrote, were generally written by another scribe that he would dictate them to, because he didn't speak all these languages. This is a traveling dude. Even in today's world, the traveling that he did is pretty freaking impressive if you actually see a map of the places Paul has been. Now, that word for perfect love casts out fear sounds like this. Mashalamya. Mashalamya. What's in the middle of it? Shalom. What's that? Shalom. Peace. Now, we've got this weird idea of peace here in the West. We seem to think that as cessation of conflict is what peace means, but actually in Semitic languages, Aramaic, Hebrew, and all the others before it, what peace means, shalom, shlama, means the embracing of the fullness of potential. Not that there isn't conflict, but everything is seen holistically and holy, wholly. We've had this sort of ideal where we think that we have to live up to some kind of perfection in the world, and that's the whole problem. We're trying to make something perfect that's not even real. We're trying to shift details out here that aren't even real details, because all we're going to get is whatever it is that the film strip that's in our projector is going to allow. You getting what we're saying here? Now, let me say this. That word mashalamya or mashalam is an interesting word, because we were told that Judas betrayed Jesus, right? Intriguingly, exactly like the story of Typhon betraying Horus. That's a different thing, but maybe, maybe not. Intriguingly, though, there was this Gospel of Judas that popped up a few years ago in Greek, and Marvin Meyer, amazing, probably one of the most well-versed, if not the most well-versed, biblical scholar on the planet, was hired by National Geographic to head up this league of scholars that translate it. And everybody made this big deal out of it, because in Greek it said paradidom or paradidomi instead of betray. What does paradidomi mean? It means this: to fulfill, to make whole, to complete, to fulfill something that is asked of you. And everybody made this big deal. Wait a second, he didn't betray him. He just did what was asked of him. And what's even more intriguing is if you go back into almost all of the Greek scriptures referencing Judas betraying Jesus, almost every single one says para didomi. And I'm like, why is everybody making a big deal out about it in the Gospel of Judas when it was there the whole time right under their noses? Now let's think about this for a second. I know it makes great art to have a guy betraying another guy, but let's look at this really, okay? If you actually look in the Jesus teachings, especially in Aramaic, and you start pulling in some of the ancillary Gospels that weren't allowed in the Bible, anybody want to guess who were the two closest companions of Yeshua? According to what we do know, Judas and Mary Magdalene. If anybody wants to think Peter, Peter was the human ego. Peter was that. Peter was the head of the church. Peter was the thinker. He couldn't understand anything that Jesus was saying. It's funny because I can imagine Yeshua knocking on their foreheads occasionally, like, you know, Biff talking to George McFly in Back to the Future, like, anybody in there? You know, knocking, like, if you guys don't get it, my frontline disciples, how are they going to get it? Intriguingly, when it says that he turned him over, it says, Mashalamya. Now, let me ask you something. If someone was going to turn you over and you knew you were going to be crucified and hung on a stick, and you knew you were going to be tortured and maimed, who would you want to do that? For me, it would be my family. I would want to see my family to the absolute last microsecond that that door closed. How did he turn him over? With a kiss. Interesting. And then what did he do after that? What did Judas do? He hung himself. Does that sound like something that the vindictive dude's going to do? You know what's interesting? If you go back in Egyptian mythology, Typhon hung himself. I know it makes great art, but the funny thing is we've lived with this idea of a betrayal here, and we've got all this hate that we love to spew toward Judas, when all that is a yet another insane, not even reason, but excuse for us to be able to feel the hate and to feel the hatred and the fear and all of that. It's just, and oh, because it happened in the Bible, so we can feel it.
And blame it on somebody else.
Oh, yeah. You can find anything you want in the Bible. If you want, you know, let's just say it's all in there. You know, if you're looking for whatever, I'm just going to stay clean on this. Read the Old Testament especially. If you want to find some wild stuff, read it, okay? Stop acting like you did and being an expert. Actually read it, and you'll find some crazy things, and that's all I'm going to say on that, okay?
Well, tie in with that idea that Vladimir Lenin put forward, and that is when you can change the meaning of a culture's words, you can destroy the culture. And you look at that word betrayal. Betrayal is a political. Traitor is a political word. It takes Yeshua out of this, the teacher of how to connect with whole field perception, how to live out of the state of being and be in communication with the Creator on all levels, and it puts him squarely into a political game, which is where they want him, because then they can make anything of him they wish.
Which is probably what everybody thought of him anyway. They probably thought he was some kind of a physical Mashiach coming back to save the world. And they're constantly asking, when do we draw our weapons? You know, when do we go and start killing people and beheading? What did he say? I'm not here for that. But
well,
yeah, so, look at Christianity today.
Yeah, well,
it sure looks
so,
like it's here for that.
It's so powerful when you hear him after Peter waxed off the high priest's servant's ear, and Yeshua says, Peter, the reason I allowed you to bring a sword was to teach you a lesson. If you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. How different would our world be today if we could just hear that single message? Now, it doesn't matter if the sword is your tongue with rage. If you wound with that, then the one you wound is yourself. You will die from that wound that you inflict on yourself.